Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
You're listening to the New Statesman podcast. On today's episode, we discuss deal or no deal, and you ask us, will 2021 be a bad year for Labour in the polls? So Boris Johnson is back from Brussels, and the word on the street, or the word from Number 10 and from the EU, is that very large gaps remain. Is the phrase that's being used in terms of the UK and EU's positions. And a trade deal is still looking very unlikely. The new deadline is Sunday. Stephen, I think you and I, in a very healthy way, have slightly differing instincts on this. Like, I mean, I have to say, most commentators, your view is very much that no deal is by far looking like the most likely outcome at this stage.
Yeah, I got a very nice and very kind, but also very funny email in response to Morning Call, where they were like, I'm loving the combination of uppers and downers at the moment, where like, you're like, yeah, we're not going to have a deal. And then like, I was like, here's why I think we'll have a deal. They're like, you're doing a real like, sort of almost negging approach to retaining readers on our
Yeah, good cop, bad cop.
So I essentially think, right, then what this all comes down to is, do you think that Boris Johnson is a man of no principle or one principle, right? Because like one, the sort of no principle interpretation of last year is that like the government spent, and the Conservative Party spent like 3 years in this dream world where you can fix the Irish border without either having regulatory alignment between the whole of the United Kingdom and the EU. Well, I mean, and the Republic of Ireland, but obviously that is because the Republic of Ireland is an EU member and is going to remain so for the foreseeable future, that means with the EU. Or do you simply do the regulatory alignment on the island of Ireland? And Boris Johnson, as with many Conservatives, spent a large chunk of the 2016 to 19 period going, we can't possibly do this, you know, we'll leave the EU, you know, whole and entire. And then in a little over a year ago, when actually, why not put the border in the sea? And so interpretation one is that all flows from Boris Johnson basically being a fundamentally unserious grifter who like triangulates towards whatever gets him the biggest cheers. A no-deal Brexit would not get him particularly big cheers. Therefore, he will eventually go, who cares about the fishermen? Like they're a trivial part of our economy and we don't spend that much on state aid anyway. So let's just sign up to all of this stuff, right? That's like reading one, which I think, without putting words in your mouth, is basically your sort of read.
Yeah.
And then there's like read two, which is like the one thing Boris Johnson has consistently stuck his neck out for is a kind of like, you can't tell me what to do, sort of instinctive Euroscepticism, which is, you know, true when he was like making up stories at the Telegraph. It was true when he was editor of the Spectator. It was true when he was Telegraph columnist. It was true when he opted to not prioritise what many believed his political interests were, his, you know, for him, long-time political loyalty to the Cameron project, which, you know, he did back when it was a dark horse candidacy and as one of the first 14 MPs to back David Cameron, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, many people, including myself, did say, look, when he quit, having been a disaster as foreign secretary over the backstop, he was ending his own political career. And, you know, he and many of his allies thought that he was risking his political career. So there's like read two, which is actually what happened last year, is Boris Johnson had never really cared about unionism in particular, and East-West unionism, that is to say between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, never really cared about it before 2019. And he was perfectly happy to sacrifice that element in order to get the thing he has cared about, which is regulatory autonomy for Scotland, Wales, and most importantly, of course, England. And if you are a believer in scenario two, as I am, then I think that actually this kind of like maximal sovereigntist approach, which can only be met with no deal, I do think this is like Boris Johnson's, you know, I mean, we're not one, but I think, you know, I think the causes he believes in, you know, I don't think you would be in danger of having to use a second hand to count them on. But I do think this is one of them. And that's why I'm kind of in team no deal.
Anoush, you have to pick a side.
Yeah, no, it's really difficult to pick a side because I find you both very persuasive political commentators, of course. And also, I do think that everything, all of this theatre and all of the comments that are coming out of the talks, and particularly from the UK side, are to be taken with a pinch of salt. Because, you know, I remember when Downing Street declared that the Brexit talks were over and they said there was no point in Michel Barnier coming back to London and that they'd just speak to him on the phone. And they did all that theatre. I think that was in October, I think, when they passed that first artificial deadline. Well, not the first artificial deadline, but the most recent artificial deadline in October for striking a deal. And then, of course, we heard, you know, just a few weeks later, I think not even 2 weeks later, that talks were going to be intensified again. And there was all these, you know, suggestions that they'd be in the tunnel and that things were looking good and that they were reaching some kind of compromise on the sticking points. And now we've gone back on that to the sort of gloomier briefings from within the negotiations. So it's really difficult to work out what's true and what's not. And also whether there's that much rhyme or reason to it as well. I do think that we hope that the UK has some kind of grand plan, whether it's using Boris Johnson's trip to Brussels to go and suggest that he's trying his hardest to strike a deal for the event of no deal and the fallout of that, so that he can blame the EU for it rather than the UK and say, well, look, we tried everything and they were just trying to punish us or they were being unfair to us. Or whether he's using the theatre to suggest that he's sort of this strong patriotic figure and to kind of cover up for the ultimate compromise that he eventually agrees to. It's difficult to tell whether either of those scenarios is true or whether there is even a plan. You know, it does seem that there's like a lack of, I think I said this last week, a lack of willingness to address the reality of the situation, which is that there will be changes, whether there's a deal or no deal. And you can just tell that they haven't really engaged with that reality for businesses yet. So he dodged the question from Keir Starmer in PMQs yesterday about how many of the promised 50,000 customs agents will be in place by the 1st of January. He just didn't answer it. And, you know, I think that was representative of the kind of lack of preparation, lack of sort of grown-up thinking about the event of no deal, but also whatever deal they strike is going to be a fairly thin one. And so there's going to be big changes coming down the line for businesses. And I think that if you don't have that steer from government, if you don't have a suggestion, look, this is serious either way, you've got to prepare, particularly in this economic climate, then businesses themselves don't feel necessarily like it's urgent and that they need to make big changes and they need to prepare. So I think there was some polling that said a third of small businesses think that the transition period will be extended again, which isn't going to happen. But I think that's not them being stupid or not following the talks properly. That's the government sort of betraying a lack of seriousness about it and a lack of urgency. And I do think that from the way that these negotiations in recent months have fluctuated back and forth and from the latest antics, you kind of feel like there is no plan, which is sort of more terrifying than either of the two scenarios that you two are leaning towards.
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying at this point, you know, for the sake of my, you know, journalistic reputation, that I know and don't disagree with the consensus that no matter what your instincts are about what might happen, at the moment we're not anywhere close to a deal. I'm sort of not suggesting that I'm sort of looking at it differently to other people in that regard, that I think that regardless of the spin, there are like very clear differences on the three big issues of fishing, level playing field and governance that do need to be resolved. It's more, as Stephen, you were sort of framing it, it's more a question of more subjective beliefs about Boris Johnson as a politician and what he believes and what he maybe doesn't believe. that means that there's, I think, room for people being on the same page in terms of the facts, but having different instincts about what might happen. I was going to add that I listened to Brexitcast, Podception here. I listened to Brexitcast, which I haven't listened to that much, but one evening this week, when there was the announcement that the government said that it would plan on removing the sort of the controversial law-breaking clauses from the internal market bill because it was expecting a breakthrough on arrangements for the Northern Ireland protocol in the joint committee, which it has now had. There has now been that breakthrough in that agreement. I tuned into Brexitcast after that just to hear what they were saying about the likelihood of a deal or otherwise. And this is when they knew that Boris Johnson would be heading off to Brussels, but before that had happened. And I'm not going to do a podcast review on a podcast because that wouldn't be professional. But I think that my main takeaway was, I mean, I personally love Katja Adler and I think she's great. And I have my Twitter notifications turned on for her. I think, Nick, can you cut that? Because it sounds like an awful euphemism.
Leave it in.
But there was a throwaway comment from her that I thought was quite interesting, where she was sort of, she didn't say that this was a briefed opinion. It was just, I think, her own speculation, but a very well-informed opinion, where she was sort of thinking that probably if a breakthrough was to be had, it would actually be had on governance, that if you can broker some sort of agreement in terms of who will arbitrate these other sticking points and where they will be decided and resolved, if you can find a breakthrough on that, then the areas where there could be arbitration on, you know, on level playing field and on fishing would become less important. I was kind of slightly persuaded by that, and also by the idea, I mean, trade experts might write in and say that this is rubbish, but also by the idea that you might find a breakthrough by resolving the issue of governance and maybe hiving off the issue of fisheries into a separate negotiation. And then secondly, the other, I think, most instructive thing from these incredibly well-sourced journalists was a comment from Laura Koonsberg, who kind of like everyone was making the case about how far a deal is looking and how big the differences are. But she did emphasize how much the government wants a deal. And I think that's the kind of insight that you really do want from Laura Koonsberg, because she's much maligned. But just as someone who is incredibly well plugged in to the mood at the very heart of government, I think that that's an insight really worth listening to, that this government does still want a deal. And I think it is really about whether you want one in the end. If you can make a breakthrough, it's about, you know, quite how prepared you are to walk away or otherwise. And I think that just that the indication that actually maybe the thing that would look best for this government would be coming away with a deal that looks like you've stood up for Britain and pulled off some kind of magic feat of statecraft. I think that would still be the best outcome. And we've sort of said before about how the government's stated red lines make a breakthrough like that incredibly difficult. But I do think that there's room for a fudge, because so much of it is just about how it's spun rather than about the details. I mean, in those separate joint committee negotiations, Michael Gove has already agreed that the UK won't sort of backtrack on existing standards and regulations. And a sort of Brexiteer purist could argue that that is in itself a bit of a capitulation, but no one's going to view it that way. I just think in terms of the technicalities, it's like what Stephen often says about politics being more of a vibe. Actually, it's sort of about whether people are saying, oh, this backstop is terrible, or, oh, this is a great oven ready deal. And I think it's just sort of a question of whether some kind of fudge is available that means that even if some compromise is involved, that it can be plausibly argued that this is a great win for the UK. I just think that that kind of a fudge is still possible.
Yeah. And of course, with the thing about them keeping on saying that they want a deal, I noticed that they made a big show of that at PMQs, and various ministers have been saying it in interviews as well. I'm sure that's very true, and I'm sure that's what they're saying at the top of government. But that could mean two things, couldn't it? It could either mean they really want a deal and they're worried about the consequences of not having one, or it could mean they want to look like they really want a deal, and maybe they actually really do. But if it all falls apart, they don't want the British public to blame them for the fallout when they inevitably try and turn the blame onto the EU.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, and I apologise for the fact that I realise I keep using Sam Giemer as my go-to example on this, right? But the reason why I think it's like, yeah, it's a perfectly cogent thing on which people can reach radically different conclusions is because we knew during the Brexit talks, and there were a large number of Conservative MPs who thought that Brexit in general, leaving the single market in particular, was a bad idea. We also knew that there were a lot of MPs in the Conservative Party who had quite maximal views about the sovereignty issue. So, like, if you read, say, Joe Johnson's argument about Brexit, he very much was like, first preference, remain, this is what I have referendum, second preference, no deal, because everything else is, you know, like, you know, you just, you know, you pay, but you have no say, right? But what we didn't know was, of the people who broadly would echo the Joe Johnson argument, which ones of them were willing to actually break the whip and actually walk out of the Conservative Party over the issue. And I think this is the thing, is that I think, well, you know, I mean, I kind of assume that everyone is lying to me because I'm, you know, remorselessly cynical when politicians or spads or pads tell me stuff. But I think that it's true that people at the top of government will say, oh, yeah, we really want a deal. I guess I kind of take the view, right, that if they wanted one, right, ultimately we don't use any of these regulatory powers they want to have no regression clauses on now. It's a painless concession. In a kind of like art of negotiation 101, right, where you go, oh, right, so what are the things which are really important to the other lot and entirely trivial to me? And I think, yeah, obviously I'm not a trade expert either, but I think Katie Adler is exactly right. And then because if we were, I mean, obviously there will never be a deal where we get 100% of our waters access back, because that type of pooling arrangement predates EU membership and there are loads of reasons why it exists for sustainability and viability reasons, right? But if we were to have 100% of our waters back tomorrow, well, we wouldn't be able to fish it, right? The supply chains aren't there, the know-how's not there. So, like, any actual decisions on fishing can be kind of shunted into the, once you have a process to deal with it, you can just be like, oh, the process will fix it. We'll fix this via operational negotiations, which we can do without the ticking clock. But this thing is, we just don't know, and we won't know what Boris Johnson's actual priorities are. We can draw conclusions based on what we think happened last year, but in some ways we are kind of back to that Brexit, yeah, the kind of familiar thing of Brexit is like, we broadly know that like a bunch of MPs really care about this thing. Yeah, I think one thing we could say with certainty in 2016 was that some people who were in the Conservative Party on the 23rd of June 2016 were not going to remain in it. I don't think I would actually have got a single name right if you'd asked me to do a list. I think everyone who left would have been on my list of like possibles, but I definitely would not have picked out the ones who did as like my, you know, my core 14 or whatever it was who have sort of formally left. And we are kind of once again back at that thing where it's just like, well, he'll make a decision and we don't really know yet what it is he actually does care about.
I think you're right. That's the heart of it, isn't it? Is what he actually cares about. Is he really committed ideologically to not settling for the deal that will be the only deal that he can make? Or is he so much of a people pleaser, which we know from his previous political choices that he is? Is he so much of a people pleaser that that will override that ideological instinct and that he won't want to do something that will cause more pain for the public and for businesses? And perhaps he, well, we know that he usually puts public sentiment over what his MPs are telling him. So I suppose it's like political realities and how they play out in Boris Johnson's head, or the very rare few things that he is committed to. If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So we have more Brexit content for you. This is a question from an anonymous listener. It seems to me that deal or no deal, any Brexit outcome is going to be good electorally for the Tories. Either they are heroic patriots who stand up for Britain or genius deal makers doing what was thought impossible. At the same time, it strikes me that the vaccine rollout is going to be great for incumbent governments everywhere. Considering these two factors, does the pod agree with me that 2021 is going to be a bleak year for Labour in the polls? Anoush, what do you think in terms of the polling outlook for Labour next year?
Yeah, I think this question's really interesting. And my instinct would be that it will be a poor year for Labour in the polls, although it depends on what time of year that is. Because if the vaccine is rolled out in a way that means that we can go back to normal life by spring, which is one of the predictions, and then we have that sort of super election day, don't we, in May, where a number of local and devolved elections are taking place, some of which didn't happen this year because of the virus, then I think that will be bad for Labour, because there's going to be a big bounce in just people's general satisfaction that we've managed to get through the virus and that it's over and that we can live our lives. And I think if there is that return to normal life by that period, then just like what happened at the very beginning of the crisis, when we were having Rishi Sunak delivering his whatever it takes budget and Boris Johnson doing daily press conferences explaining what the government was going to do and explaining what we should do to protect ourselves from the virus. And there was a sort of bounce in the polls for the government then, because it felt like we had people who were in control, which didn't turn out just as we thought. Yeah, there was a bounce for the incumbent because of the arrival of the virus, and that's fluctuated since. But I think once the virus goes, there will be a similar bounce, because people will just be so thrilled to be living their normal lives again. And although we've spoken about many people's livelihoods and lifestyles and just futures that have been ruined by this thing, I still think that there's going to be a wave of optimism once we come out of the restrictions. So if the timing is in spring, then that could be bad news for Labour in those May elections. But, and this but is important, I don't think that the timing will be spring. It's more likely that the vaccine is going to be rolled out to everyone more like around summertime. And so it could be that we're coming out of the restrictions, or some form of the restrictions, by a bit later in the year. So that waiting time, you know, yes, we've had all the excitement of the first vaccines, but I think that's going to lose its novelty quite quickly when we're waiting and waiting for everyone to get a chance to have it, and for various different vaccines to be rolled out as well, which could bring their own challenges. That waiting time will probably be an opportunity for Labour to do what it has been doing very well, and scrutinising the government's response and the way it spends its money and the way it communicates what it's doing to the public, etc. So that could be a better period for Labour in the polls. But I still think once we come out of all of that by summer or by the end of summer, there will be a bounce for the government. So either way, it could be bad for Labour in the polls, but I think the spring scenario could be worse because of that election day in May.
It's a really interesting one. So yeah, because I'm just this cool, I wrote a while ago that I thought after the end of a vaccine, when vaccines came in, there would be a surge in support for incumbent government. So I semi-agree with half of this question, right? Which is then, will like people being able to have spontaneous human interactions, you know, to be able to like, you know, have physical contact and have all of the reasons why everyone is having a pretty terrible time, will the ending of those things cause a general uptick in like people's attitudes to like whether or not the country is going in the right direction? Yes. And so you would therefore assume that every incumbent government will do slightly better from this. Now, the maddening thing is after I wrote this up, I checked back to see what happened in opinion polling across Europe as and when they were able to end rationing in the war. Now, the annoying thing is there isn't very much of it, but so this is a very broad data set. But the interesting thing is actually the evidence isn't a bounce.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, which was one of those things which I really wasn't expecting. Now, obviously the Conservatives gained votes and seats in 1955, first post-rationing election, and most incumbent parties were rewarded electorally. But the thing I would have expected, which is to kind of be able to be like, oh, right, Gallup in June 1954, Gallup in July 1954, there is a clear increase in doesn't appear to happen, and that doesn't appear to happen anywhere in Western Europe. Although, given the Labour Party consistently led with Gallup throughout that parliament, and then in 1955, when presumably some of that was starting to work its way through, the Conservatives go into a small but significant lead, which they never really lose, and then they win the 55 election fairly emphatically in the Commons, with that small but significant lead remaining intact. I guess the thing is, right, is now obviously there's like the possibility that everything I think about no deal is wrong, and then, you know, we either have a deal, in which case, you know, people will be relieved about it happening. But to be honest, I think these two forces are actually in complete opposition to each other. There's like the thing that is going to happen to make the government's life a lot easier, which will be the fact we will all be happier. Than the vaccine is like the single biggest economic stimulus really conceivable to imagine. And we'll also just, people will just be happier in general because we don't have to live in this horrible fashion. But like, people are not going to feel warmly patriotic towards a government that they broadly stopped trusting when Dominic Cummings broke lockdown, right? Like, yeah, then there are metrics which the government wasn't hurt on at all, but fundamentally the big changes were in like attitudes about trust on our side, heart in the right place, all of that kind of stuff. I'm not going to think, when people basically do think that we ought to have just extended until COVID was over, I'm not going to go like, if we have a no deal, I'm glad we're sticking it up to the French. Like, broadly, when you look at people's attitudes, even like diehard leavers, they go like, oh yeah, of course the EU is like behaving selfishly and like putting its own interests first. It's the Prime Minister's job to respond to that, not to go, oh, they're being selfish and I was unable to deal with it. So I actually think that like the only reason not to be like, yeah, the locals will be terrible because of the major feel-good factor of the end of the vaccine is bluntly, then I think then we're heading for a Brexit scenario which will drain all of that goodwill, that will mean then we will, instead of having a kind of spring back economically, we'll have a very painful January, February, March, April, May, June, July. But obviously, you know, if we get a deal, or if it turns out then no deal is this fantastic thing, then they are able to leverage into like doing like radical deregulation that makes us all wealthier, which, I mean, I suppose we have to give intellectual house room to the idea that these ideas aren't completely wrong-headed and that we could be wrong about everything. But bluntly, I don't think that's likely. But I guess that's where I'm sort of at on it. Alva, what do you think?
So I think that predicting as far as the end of 2021 is not really my strong suit. But I think I probably actually slightly... I mean, I agree with a lot of your undernushes working, but thinking in the more immediate term, which, because we will quite soon be in 2021 anyway, I think that we can't overestimate the government's capacity for messing things up when we think that it's an open goal. I mean, firstly, I'm just not convinced that the Christmas policy is going to go well for any of us. And I know that, you know, the devolved governments across the UK also have a part to play in that. So that might play out a bit differently politically, maybe for that reason. But I think already Nicola Sturgeon's messaging around that has been a bit different to Boris Johnson's. And I think ultimately it's the UK government that will have to own that. So I think that Christmas potentially not looking so good. January and February, I think that for all that we've talked a lot, and I think rightly, about the big difference between a deal and no deal, I think that because, as you were saying, Anoush, businesses are just not prepared for the changes at the end of the transition period either way, because we've left it so late and it's so down to the wire. I think that we are still going to see huge disruption and very bad pictures of queues in Kent and people talking about the real economic impact of Brexit confusion. And, you know, I actually still don't know how much people pay attention to disruption in Northern Ireland, and a lot of it has already been resolved. But I just think that if you hear testimony from people saying that they can't get access to certain products, I think if there are proper tangible facts about food prices going up, or, you know, we still have a deal, but there are huge delays and there's still massive confusion and people don't know what paperwork to do and people are losing loads of money because they've been trying to send a whole lorry full of fresh food over to France and it decayed on the way because the wait was so long. I think that like the combination of all of that bad press plus potentially a third wave in coronavirus cases. And I think quite a lot of logistical difficulties with rolling out the vaccine that I don't really have much confidence in the government being able to pull it off. I think that actually maybe, you know, maybe we'll be sitting here in April with lots of, you know, firm opinions about the logistics of cold chains and how the government has messed that up and how they should have known X, Y, Z. And I just think that there are lots of things there where there's just like potential for a lot of negative press. And I think maybe a lot of the good press around Brexit already happened for the government. I think that was when, you know, they got Brexit done on January the 31st. And, you know, even if there's a little bit of praise for getting a deal or, you know, he stood up for Britain in the case of no deal, I'm just not sure if that would have much effect. And then I'm also just not convinced. I appreciate that when people have been vaccinated and things can go back to normal, there should probably be a huge uplift in the performances of incumbent governments along with the economic recovery. But I just think that that's likely to happen towards the end of the year, and also that maybe the local elections and the Scottish government elections will kind of set the tone for the rest of the year. And I'm not convinced that the Conservatives will necessarily do that well in those for big reasons and small reasons. I don't see them doing necessarily that well in Scotland. But then also on things like that housing algorithm, which I think they are thinking of dropping, but things like that I think mean that on the ground in lots of places in Conservative strongholds, individual Conservative politicians are a bit worried about how they're going to do. And I can just imagine that like Conservatives will do badly in those elections or worse than expected. And that will set the tone for the rest of the year in the same way that those European elections set the tone for the 2019 election, even though by that point the politics was very different. So I think I can't really imagine that we'll be talking about next year being a bad polling year for Labour, even if a lot of the things that we're predicting do happen and there is the economic recovery from COVID and so on. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and my colleagues Stephen Bush and Anoush Shakelian. We're produced by Nick Hilton and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.